Thank you so much. Vorrei ringraziare Linda e Carla per avermi invitato a questo convegno. I'm really excited to participate. Mio libro sul teatro anatomico è stato pubblicato parecchio tempo fa, nel 2011, e oggi vorrei riconsiderare le mie idee su teatri anatomici e la storia di anatomia. In particolare vorrei pensare un po' di più dell'idea che il teatro anatomico è prodotto un orientamento alla conformità. Vediamo questo nel silenzio degli studenti, per esempio. Ok, in inglese. The anatomical theater, when I began to study it, frequently served as a placeholder in the historiography of science. The history of medicine was, and too often today still is, a latent rather than manifest part of the history of science. The anatomy theater evoked a kind of origin story for modern science. It offered early glimpses, instances, intimations of topics that remain important to accounts of the development of modern science, such as observation, objectivity, empiricism, experiment, and so forth. The extent to which the anatomy theater was a place for seeing, as theatrum would suggest, however, was for me a more complicated question. Andrea Carlino explained in his Books of the Body, quote, "The moment that dissection began to be permitted, anatomy could have been rewritten and freed from the authority of Galen and the monopoly of the Galenists. This did not happen, perhaps because between the 14th and the 16th centuries, cadavers were cut up at the universities for exclusively educational purposes. The question then becomes, why did two centuries have to pass before there could be a change in the application of human dissection? Was direct observation not the principal instrument for acquiring a general knowledge of nature and of the human body in particular?" So Carlino goes on to mount a robust argument about the intractable authority of book learning, and his account considers resistance to change not only as an anthropological condition, but also as a feature of textual or intellectual, as well as institutional habits and commitments. But I want to return today to the educational purposes for cutting up a cadaver, to the events that eventually took place inside anatomical theaters in order to address the fuller impact of the anatomical theater, how the theater altered the anatomy demonstration and the participation of professors as well as students. In part, I would like to ask why it mattered at all that the anatomy demonstration took place inside a theater. So according to the university statutes, which were established early by the first decades of the 1400s, the anatomy demonstration would take place in the winter months. It would last up to 6 weeks. One or two cadavers would be made available for this, and they would be the bodies of executed criminals. And in Padua, at least, they had to be foreign bodies as well. Furthermore, as everyone knows, here probably, the demonstration proceeded with the lector reciting passages from a text while the demonstrator or ostensor indicated to the dissector the parts of the body that should be dissected. According to the 1545 statutes in Padua, the dissection would follow a lecture and reading of the Anatomia of Mondino, a dissecting manual that draws on the anatomical studies of Galen, as well as the medieval scholastic tradition of anatomizing. So we can note a few things about these statutes. First, they emphasize the authority of the text. Indeed, the statutes of the medical faculty in Padua from 1570 developed this aspect even further, They stated that teachers were warned not to present views opposed to those in the text, and that they were urged to expound the text according to recognized authorities, so the authority of the text. Secondly, the statutes were regulatory. They were meant to bring order to a kind of potential chaos. This was developed even further in a couple of decrees that came out in the 1580s, one of which mandated that students were supposed to listen quietly or be excluded from the demonstration, that the procession into the theater would be led by the rector, who would be followed by the professor and then students, and that no student can sit in the first row without incurring a fine. So here we find a protocol or a script that structures and further regulates the Galenic anatomy demonstration. It clarifies the order and hierarchy that materializes in the demonstration, and that hierarchy also reflects the hierarchy of the university. I would point out that the regulation also extends to the silence of the students. So these features are relatively fixed, statutes are permanent, and they serve to regulate the anatomy demonstration and at the same time make it intelligible as a part of university culture, where professors have authority over students, professors derive their authority from texts. When permanent anatomy theaters were eventually constructed, they were an extension of university culture, and the knowledge produced within them was inextricable from the more pervasive concerns about orthodoxy, about textual authority, and even about compliance. I want to point out quickly that such a view runs counter to a great deal of early historiography on the scientific revolution. That historiography has tended to privilege novelty and align it with subversive and iconoclastic tendencies. So this is especially notable in Vesalius's, in criticism on Vesalius. The Anatomy Theater in Bologna, though, for example, has been described as subversive because of its connections to carnival with its rituals of inverting power structures, if people know Giovanna Ferrari's excellent article on this. And yet, if we read that article carefully, such associations were not prominent until the 18th century. In Padua, and I think for much of the early modern period, the Anatomy Theater was a site of regulation and compliance. But anatomy theaters were not mere anatomy demonstrations were not mere repetitions. A full account of the anatomy theater will therefore require an understanding of the changing substance of the demonstrations and methods of inquiry, such as when a demonstration provides ocular proof and when it provides scientia or natural philosophical knowledge. But today I want to focus on the performance, the changing nature of the performance. To do so, I want to draw on Diana Taylor's work on performance theory, where she develops the tension between the archive, which she identifies with permanence, and the repertoire. So the archive is a kind of container for things like the statutes and decrees that I just spoke about. In contrast, the repertoire refers to embodied practices, and for the theater, broadly conceived, it tends to emphasize gesture, orality, the individuation of actors, and even idiosyncrasy. All those features that are a part of the theater, but are ephemeral, they're non-reproducible. So Diana Taylor writes, quote, "The archive and the repertoire exist in a constant state of interaction, even though the tendency has been to banish the repertoire to the past. Her project is in part to recover a history of the repertoire that demonstrates its significance to both the historical development and contemporary understanding of theater, a project that strikes me as especially useful for the Anatomy Theater, to both identify the repertoire and make it integral to the history of the Anatomy Theater and even the history of anatomy." So in Padua, in Padua, as is well known, there were two anatomy theaters, permanent ones, built consecutively. The second permanent theater, which still exists today, was completed in 1595. Both theaters were intended to house orderly demonstrations, and both at different times failed to do so. This can be seen in the example from the anatomy demonstration in 1588, 89. So on the 23rd of January, 7 days into the demonstration, the anatomist began his afternoon lecture on the topic of generation and the formation of the fetus in utero, a topic obviously not tightly linked to the male corpses that were on view. But he was interrupted. The theater was, quote, besieged by many people, friends of the student assistants, the Masari, and members of the local community, end quote. So the overcrowding was further described in terms of noise and confusion. It also led to a seating problem, though, of course, in the theater, there were no seats. People stood in zones, in particular zones. The beadle tried to handle the latecomers, and especially the syndic. Pause. The syndic was a university-educated man who served as a legal overseer and sometimes secretary for the rector. So the syndic could not make it to his usual standing place near the professors, and he had tried to stand with the student presidents, the students who were presidents of their nazione at the university. The beadle ordered the assistants to give him a place. But the situation continued to deteriorate, and a transalpine student writing the account said that he should really refer to the Sicilians as assassins because they neglected, quote, the authority of the entire university, end quote, as they interrupted the event. The disruption continued with disgraceful words, and a fight broke out. Finally, the anatomist forbid the Sicilians to undertake anything further against the syndic. In the end, the Sicilians left the theater. From this episode, the problems of regulation emerge prominently. The theater was intended to house a large audience, one that reflected the diversity of the academic community, both its horizontal relations, so between students, and also its vertical relations, which flowed from the professor to the rector, to the syndic, to the assistants, to the presidents of the student nazione, and then to the students themselves. This community became disordered, literally. So the hierarchy that was supposed to materialize failed to do so. An additional observation might be made about this episode. In the moment of the conflict, during the performance, the syndic had entered late. He was unable to take his place. He went to stand with the presidents of the student nations. When the Sicilian students obstructed his passage, the syndic opposed them. And the Transalpine students who described the episode wrote that the syndic, quote, did not suffer himself to be moved from the place which he occupied even by the breadth of a fingernail. We, I think, would understand the breadth of a fingernail as a spatial description, but the sources for the phrase, one was Plautian Comedy and the other was from the Bible, indicate that it can be an argumentative position as well, where the sense of the phrase conveys an unwillingness to fall away from an object of devotion. So here, the performative history of anatomy includes not only the display of the professor's authority, in concert with books and bodies, but also the rehearsal of a kind of a commitment, an embodied element that was powerful enough to draw the attention of these Transalpine students who sought a fairly unusual Latin phrase to express the nature of the syndic's devotion. His devotion was not only to anatomy, but also to the theater, to the hierarchy it was meant to instantiate. These, I think, are features of the repertoire. Idiosyncratic and ephemeral, they reflect important things about the theater and how it was experienced. So in addition to failures of that kind, there were also instances that we might call creative adaptation. In 1589, the anatomist Fabricius of Aquapendente gave an anatomy demonstration that began with the dissection of the muscles related to speech. He paused to connect the topic to his particular audience of students. A Transalpine student describing the scene put it this way. The anatomist began on this occasion to ridicule the pronunciation of Latin of various student nations. In the midst, he arrived at our praiseworthy nation saying, quote, The pronunciation of the Transalpines is hard and slow, since they wish to pronounce words while they compress the mouth excessively. This would be the cause, so that always they pronounce awkwardly the fuf for the vuf. And for the record, he demonstrated it. I'm not going to demonstrate it. Imitating the speech of the Transalpines, the anatomist meant he who drinks wine lives a long time. But the students found his joke that they slurred their speech and spoke, as they said, like drunkards, humiliating. By their account, Fabricius put forth these words ad nauseum, and he was unable to contain his own laughter. In their notes, they also said that they then felt exposed in the presence of all the other nations, all the other student nations. The joke had called attention to them as foreigners, flagging their status as linguistic, demographic, and because of their Protestant leanings, the Protestant leanings were assumed, religious outsiders. They were outsiders in all those senses. The description captures the less obvious or explicit functions of the anatomy theater, its ability to configure and recognize social relations of students and their professor, and its ability to connect anatomical themes quite directly to issues of both classical education, Latinity, and also to civility, the manner of speaking. The theater was a new space in the institutional landscape of the university. It was regulated by statutes, but here the theater allowed the anatomist to target foreign students, yes, and also to remind all students of a connection to the ancients, and that that connection was both important and perhaps something more easily achieved by Southern Europeans. Italians, I think, spoke Latin in the right way. The scene, though comical, encourages us to consider the regulatory function of the theater in specifically theatrical terms. Once humiliated, it's hard to imagine that the Transalpine students would be encouraged to speak up. In fact, they would be encouraged to remain silent with their compressed lips. This was the result of the anatomist's performance, which he too created by mimicking first a Transalpine student speaking Latin and then a drunk person speaking Latin. The theater opened up possibilities derived from its theatrical or dramatic potential for students and for teachers, and for the ways that a demonstration could proceed. So there are additional dramatic elements that form part of the repertoire of the anatomy theater. For example, musicians, lute players were sometimes brought into the theater at the end of the century in order to please the spectators and enhance the tranquility of the theater, so to limit disruption. But I want to conclude. So by assembling not only the archive, but also the repertoire of the anatomy theater, I think we are able to recover a performative history of the anatomy theater, one that highlights the regulatory function of the theater and how that regulation was experienced, what happened when the theater failed, and what possibilities appeared inside the theater. These shaped also the meaning of demonstration itself inside the anatomy theater at the university. So if I can end with a contrast to the anatomical demonstrations that took place in Venice around this time, Leonardo Fioravanti, an empiric, was a sharp critic of learned medicine and especially of anatomy. And he recounted an exchange he had in 1564 with the head of the Signoria in Venice, who was named Ottaviano Senese. Senese was learned, but he wasn't a medical professional or a practitioner. But he told Fioravanti he had seen 11 dissections in the year of 1564. And when Fioravanti asked him what was so important about these anatomy demonstrations, Ottaviano explained that they were necessary for physicians and surgeons. And eventually, the reason was because in seeing an anatomy, a dissection, you could learn where and how to let blood. But how, Fioravanti exclaimed, could you learn anything about bloodletting from a cadaver that had been exsanguinated, drained of its blood? Here is an old criticism of human dissection, that it is useless for medical practice. But Fioravanti raised it in Venice in 1564. So as we consider anatomy and theater, it may be worth asking what kinds of responses to anatomy were suppressed inside the anatomy theater, and what was the changing meaning of demonstration itself? Fioravanti stood outside of the anatomy theaters, also outside the university mostly, and for him, the body was supposed to be the living body, vital, flowing, blood-filled, a conception that was fragmented at best inside the anatomy theater and the university settings in which medical knowledge was produced. Equally, Fioravanti's critique reveals, I think, how far the anatomy demonstration had developed. It was much more by the end of the century, an ocular demonstration, just as the theater, I think, was more than a place for seeing. Thank you.